I'm CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark. If it feels like everyone has a cold at your holiday gathering, there's probably a reason. 23 states right now say they're experiencing high or very high levels of respiratory illness. ABC medical correspondent Dr. Darian Sutton says this is to be expected as more people gather indoors.
We've seen a 200% increase in influenza, raising in about 44 states, a 60% increase in RSV, children under four being the most at risk, and a 50% increase in the cases of COVID. People over the age of 65 representing the most risk in terms of hospitalization and death.
Doctors say the best thing to do is to stay home if you're sick. Former President Trump on his social media platform praising the Supreme Court's rejection of special counsel Jack Smith's request to immediately weigh in on the question of presidential immunity. And officials in Gaza say more than 90 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes today. This is ABC News. Pair of Colorado paramedics who injected 23-year-old Elijah McClain with ketamine during a struggle with police in 2019, leading to his death, were convicted. Attorney General Phil Weiser said,
"The world, Elijah, and especially his mom, Jeanine McClain, deserve to have the full story told. That's what justice demanded."
Rail crossings at the U.S.-Mexico border are reopening. ABC's Alex Stone says commerce is moving again. The initial closure was in response to a surge of migrants.
After shutting them down this week, U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the rail crossing bridges from Mexico into Eagle Pass and El Paso, Texas, are reopening. Thousands of rail cars have been stuck, waiting at a cost of $100 million a day in delayed shipments. Everything from car parts to beer stuck, unable to cross. CBP says it has surged personnel into the region because of the recent influx of arriving migrants.
I'm Brian Clark, ABC News.
Her name is Pam Yonke, but you can just call the host of the Midwest Farm Report the Fabulous Farm Babe.
That's right, and the Fabulous Farm Babe is now part of the Civic Media team on your local station, Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM in Hayward. Here's show host Todd Alba with the announcement.
She is a broadcast legend. Doesn't matter whether you're a farm person, ag person, a producer, or just a good old Wisconsinite or a Packer fan. Pam Yonke, welcome to Civic Media.
My pleasure, my pleasure. Yeah, lifelong Wisconsinite. I grew up on a small dairy farm in northeast Wisconsin, O'Connell County. Stop and think about the work being done 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to make sure that you and I are the best fed in the world.
Join the Fabulous Farm Babe Pam Yonke on the Buzz of the North, WBZH 910 AM in Hayward.
Your Midwest Farm Report, weekdays from 5 until 6 a.m.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Wisconsin ranks 22nd among the 50 states when it comes to health care. That's according to the United Health Foundation. Mike Moan spoke with local public health officials about what's working in Wisconsin and what's not.
Some of the state's strengths include a low prevalence of non-medical drug use and encouraging results for physical activity. But it's 49th in the nation for public health funding. Dave Reinders leads Health and Human Services for Buffalo County. He notes that most of his budget is tied to local property taxes. He suggests more outside resources could help expand efforts in areas such as tobacco use prevention.
We're dealing with vaping. We're dealing with other ways of consuming nicotine that are being made available and marketed to children. But what we don't have is really a strong enough voice and presence to really work with community intensively.
Watchdogs note that Wisconsin's near-bottom ranking for public health spending is partially influenced by what it receives from the CDC. On a national scale, UnitedHealthcare's Rhonda Randall says they're seeing concerning trends for chronic health conditions such as diabetes and heart disease.
This is something that we have been concerned about for quite some time. And when we looked at the data at this year's report, it's really unfortunate to see that the number of adults living with chronic conditions in the United States is the highest we've seen it.
Wisconsin ranks 28th in the nation for the percentage of adults with multiple chronic conditions. Randall notes this trend comes amid a decline in licensed primary caregivers around the country. She says this prompts a call to action for individuals to analyze the choices they make that affect their health and for communities to pull as many supportive resources together as possible. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bauer.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
We have some fog this morning that's going to burn off. It'll stay cloudy through the day today with a high right around 44 this afternoon. The wind out of the south at 5 to 15. Tonight, cloudy showers late tonight, our low 39. Tomorrow, cloudy with rain, a high of 50. More rain, maybe mixing with a little snow tomorrow night into Christmas Day. I'm meteorologist Sean Cable. Right now, it's 39.
Hayward's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel.
You don't know me, but I'm your brother.
Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, December 23rd. This is our second hour of our Saturday morning broadcast. Thank you for once again joining me and my wonderful producer, Anya, as we talk with you this morning, as we always do, about the major news items, the stories affecting law and government and the aspiration for justice in America. Spending most of our first hour talking about state Supreme Courts, this major decision coming out of our Wisconsin Supreme Court, ordering the drawing of new maps, new lines for our Assembly and our Senate right here in the state of Wisconsin, talking about the implications of that for voting in 2024, chatting also about possibilities of appeal to the United States Supreme Court and the options for doing that, the merits of doing that as well, and then also talking just before our top of the hour break about the Colorado Supreme Court, different kind of case, finding that Donald Trump, a candidate for the presidency, that his name cannot appear on the primary ballot there in Colorado based upon an invocation of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment to the Constitution that prohibits someone who's previously taken an oath to the Constitution, who then engages in insurrection with respect to that very document, the very principles in that document, finding that he cannot appear on the ballot, that case almost certainly going to the Supreme Court. Again, not only because of the importance of the merits of that, but because of the many jurisdictions out there that are wrestling with similar issues, including, as I said right before the break, this interesting situation in Maine, other cases around the country, some of them finding that the particular Section 3 does not apply and that Donald Trump has an entitlement to appear on the ballot, others going arguably in opposite directions, at least in terms of some of the arguments being made before those judicial and legislative bodies out there. And so the Supreme Court probably has a significant interest in avoiding sort of the patchwork approach. They often pursue cases. They grant certiorari in situations where they need to resolve splits in the country, splits in the circuits, splits arguably now among state Supreme Courts coming to different resolutions of this important issue that relate to nothing less than who is going to be our next president of the United States of America. Thank you for joining me in all of these discussions. We're going to spend some more time talking in just a few moments about the Supreme Court, a couple of other things that it has done this past week, both in connection with cases it will not decide, one coming out of the District of Columbia and a criminal prosecution right now going on with respect to Donald Trump, another one coming out of the Seventh Circuit having to do with firearms about a week and a half or so ago, major decision affirming a lower court decision having to do with firearms in the state of Illinois. We're going to talk about both of those as the Supreme Court continues to have a great impact upon our lives and livelihoods throughout the nation, including right here in the state of Wisconsin. As always, we encourage your phone calls at 844-967-2789. You can also drop a comment into our online feed. And indeed, indeed, we've got some folks who are listening this morning. Appreciate very much those comments. One of you very thoughtfully noted, in connection with the Wisconsin Supreme Court decision, that as a practical matter, after the maps are redrawn, presumably by our Supreme Court, to render them consistent with this contiguity requirement in our Constitution, to make them more fair, one of you wrote in, and noting that even after the maps are drawn, after the lines are redrawn, highly likely people on all sides of the political aisle indicating, predicting based upon demographics, the locations of populations in our state, that even after those maps are drawn to become more fair, the Republicans may still have an advantage in Wisconsin, at least a numeric advantage when it comes to populating the Senate and the Assembly as well. That could well be. And that is democracy in America. That's the kind of thing that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is hoping to identify, which is a mechanism forward to make them more fair, not necessarily to accomplish a political result, but to ensure that representation is a part of our process here in the state of Wisconsin, sending people to Madison who are truly representative. The comment by one of you that by being more competitive, our legislature will need capital N, capital E, capital E, capital D, need to really address the needs of Wisconsinites. And that's the point of that terrific comment that one of you wrote in about, which is that this is all about addressing the real needs of the people of the state of Wisconsin, ensuring that representation there in Madison, in our legislature, in our legislative body that makes important decisions about the laws, how we are governed here, is truly representative, and that we address the substantive issues. This is not just about politics. And in fact, that the primary focus should be about the substantive issues in what? In areas of education and healthcare and environment and commerce and industry and the arts and all those kinds of things that we think about when it comes to a government that is responding, as the writer indicated, to the needs of the people in our state. That's what this decision is really all about, that the representatives making those decisions about all those substantive areas are representative of you. Thank you very much for that text. Appreciate that. And also appreciate other callers calling in this morning, including Mark. You've been on the line for a while. As always, Mark, appreciate your comment or your question, your inquiry about the subject matters that we're talking about this morning. Mark, glad to have you with me.
Yeah, it's just people know that I'm probably Mr. Contiguous and Mr. Compact because I've been arguing on that issue for quite a while.
Yes,
now.
You have. That's a good thing.
And it's particularly rich. You know, I saw some of the, I couldn't read the whole dissents because I just was getting too angry that the sniping little comments made by Annette Ziegler, you know, just coming out and attacking the majority, new majority of the Supreme Court, complaining about, oh, this is just a political attack. We've never seen a constitutional assault, you know, quite like this. Well, need I remind people about the fact that a few years back that the Wisconsin Supreme Court with a conservative majority actually overturned Wisconsin, you know, the ability of politicians to, you know, coordinate with outside parties, you know, to bolster their campaigns, you know, Scott Walker and the whole John Doe 2 thing where, and then after that was over, they overturned the law, a law that had previously been upheld, if I remember correctly. They overturned the law and then they ordered all the evidence destroyed, which is kind of remarkable that they would come out and do something like that. Under, I think Gableman was the one who wrote that decision. But it's just that the Supreme Court failed, previous Supreme Court then failed in their obligation, it would be my understanding, to make sure that the maps in the past were constitutional, and they certainly weren't because they did not meet the standards of contiguousness and compact that. And the Supreme Court, well, this comes up every 10 years, but it's the Supreme Court's responsibility to make sure that the law is constitutional. And it seems to me that these conservative supposed guardians of the Constitution should have actually looked at the Constitution and said, hey, guys, the maps do not meet this constitutional requirement. What are you going to do about it? And maybe part of the problem there is that under a law system that somebody has to bring that
right,
to this court's
right.
attention. But it's remarkable that, if I remember correctly, wasn't Brian Hagedorn one of the advisors to Scott Walker when the previous maps were drawn back in 2011? And if he was being completely honest, he should have probably not had anything to do with, recused himself in cases involving districting because he was involved in a partisan political, the drawing of the maps.
And all of that, Mark, right? All of that going to the legitimacy of decision making. One of the concerns I think that is implicit in your comment this morning is this notion that we anticipate, even though in every state of our union, including here in Wisconsin, we have supposedly nonpartisan elections for Supreme Court justices. We know that ideologically they fall down different sides of the aisle. We would hope that even in the midst of that, one day, we can be in a situation where the partisan politics that animate a lot of our discussions today would not make their way into the court. And as you have identified, Mark, so well here today, that the Supreme Court justices, regardless of their own political views, how they voted in the past and in their own private lives, would bring to the analysis a focus on the Constitution. Again, in this case, compactness, as you've said, contiguity, previously issues about the Voting Rights Act. What does the law say? And how should we accomplish what our other listener this morning talked about in terms of fairness? What is fair in terms of representative democracy? Marcus, always appreciate tremendously your comment and your observation this morning. Always, always glad to have those. And we also have on the line Cindy from Appleton. Cindy, thank you for calling in this morning. Your question or your inquiry about what we're discussing this morning on our broadcast.
Well, I'm just going to make a comment that I'm so glad this happened. I just hope it doesn't get hung up. I hope the SCOTUS does not take this on and dumps it back to the state so that we can get this done before the next election. But I'm telling you, if you look at the maps before the Republicans gerrymandered them and looked at them afterwards, it is so obvious what they did that I just can't even believe there's any question about the contiguousness of these maps.
Right. And frankly, again, I think I have not spent a huge amount of my own time doing that, but Cindy, you have, others have identified this contiguity problem. As I said in our previous segment, the number of districts, Senate districts and Assembly districts, Cindy, your good point, where we do not have contiguity here is remarkable. It's playing the majority of all of those seats out there. It is, the justices in the majority have said, it is in violation. It is contrary to the fundamental notion that's been in our Constitution. We have had this history, Cindy, which you've again implicitly suggested, where the courts have looked in the other direction and said, well, we'll give kind of short shrift to the contiguity argument. Shouldn't be doing that. And the justices this past week saying, let's get back to what the Constitution requirements are. Let's ensure once again fairness, and let's restore some sense of representative government to what we're doing here in the state of Wisconsin. So, Cindy, appreciate again your comment this morning and the comments of all of you calling in this morning to talk about these very important issues on our syllabus. Included, as Cindy just said, this concern about whether or not the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, will take this case up. Supreme Court will probably almost certainly take up the Colorado case. But we know that the Supreme Court does have discretion to say yes and no. And in fact, this past week, they said no in two other major cases. We're going to talk about those in just a moment. One of them, as you've been hearing on the Civic Media news feed this morning, one of them related to this issue about Donald Trump's immunity defense as he's going forward in that criminal prosecution. We'll talk about that case and a Seventh Circuit case in which the Supreme Court also denied this writ of certiorari and said we're not going to be reviewing those cases. Stay with us for this next segment of our discussion about what's going on in the United States Supreme Court.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Latrell spent more than 8 years in foster care. His world changed when he was adopted at 15 with help from the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption.
I think about how much we love him, and I wish we could have had him for his entire childhood.
The foundation is changing the lives of thousands of teens waiting in foster care. You can help. Learn more at DaveThomasFoundation.org.
One in four Americans today are living with a disability.
I'm one of them. People with disabilities are extremely talented, resilient problem solvers that have so much to offer. And we've got a trusted ally on our side, an organization we can rely on, Easter Seals. Easter Seals is leading the way to full equity, inclusion, and access to healthcare, employment, and education for people with disabilities, families, and communities. That's my Easter Seals. Make it yours.
Learn more and get involved at EasterSeals.com.
This is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Welcome back. We are talking this morning almost exclusively about courts in America. Lots of big things happening this past week, both in the state of Wisconsin and also in Washington, D.C., where our United States Supreme Court, much the focus of attention appropriately by every American out there. The Supreme Court, again, as Cindy noted, has this option of reviewing or not reviewing cases coming up, not only from the lower federal courts, typically the appeals courts, but also determining whether or not it's going to review state Supreme Court cases as well. And so Cindy expressing the view, the hope, the aspiration that the federal Supreme Court does not choose to review the recent decision just yesterday of our Wisconsin Supreme Court on this redistricting case. They have the discretion to say yes or no. And also plainly focusing on the Colorado case. More likely, they would take that case because of its national implications about who is and who is not on the ballot. All of that focusing on Donald Trump, a present candidate for the presidency, hoping to return to the White House in November of 2024, being sworn in again if that happens in January of 2025. Right now, as you know well, having listened to this broadcast, having consumed other news reporting out there here on civic media and other news sources, you know well that the United States Department of Justice, through Special Counsel Jack Smith, is prosecuting right now that candidate, Donald Trump, in the federal district court, the criminal court there, case being presided over by Judge Tanya Chutkan. Lots of focus on that in recent weeks, including in this pretrial stage, the argument by counsel for defendant Trump that he is absolutely immune, completely immune from any prosecution of this sort for conduct in which he engaged while he is president of the United States of America. The executive immunity issue looming large in this case, which is the one that right now is the focus of the federal and the Supreme Court cases pending out there in Washington, D.C. Well, major news here. What happened, of course, is that Tanya Chutkan said in an opinion of not too long ago, and an opinion that is just as compelling from my perspective as is the Colorado Supreme Court decision here, as compelling as our Wisconsin Supreme Court decision is with respect to redistricting, a decision by Tanya Chutkan that the presidential immunity doctrine, this theory, this argument advanced by the defense, holds no water. That indeed there is no one, including the President of the United States of America, who is immune from criminal prosecution if you have, in fact, engaged in crimes while you are the President of the United States of America. No one is above the law, repeated often in the annals of our history, in the discussions of immunities, how far those extend, not to the presidency. Tanya Chutkan reaffirming that in her lower court decision. That having been appealed now to the D.C. Court of Appeals, the higher appellate court there, and that court soliciting, having solicited arguments, written arguments, has scheduled an oral argument for January 9th, coming up right after the new year. We know that case is pending right now in front of a three-judge panel, as is always the case when these cases go up to an appellate court. That three-judge panel is made up of Judges Karen Henderson. For what it is worth, again, we hesitate always to identify them by who they appointed them, but regrettably, that's been a part of our analysis these days. We would like to think the federal judges would bring these larger issues of rightness and law and legality to the fore, based not upon partisan views, but rather upon what the law requires. But Karen Henderson, appointed many years ago by George H.W. Bush, also joined on this panel by Florence Pan and Michelle Childs. Both of them are appointed by
President Joe Biden. So you've got a panel, that three-judge panel, that right now is going to entertain argument on the legitimacy of Judge Chutkan's decision, finding that the absolute immunity doctrine does not attach to Donald Trump, does not provide him for protection. Meanwhile, as you know, Jack Smith has gone and said to the Supreme Court, please take this case immediately, jumping basically over the appeals court. Why? Because he's looking at the calendar and he knows that Tanya Chutkan has scheduled this to be go to trial, or pick a jury, beginning on Monday, March 4th, which is about 10 weeks from this coming Monday. That's not a lot of period of time, right? And so Jack Smith, looking at the calendar, has said, United States Supreme Court, take this case, resolve this case, and tell us definitively, in the interest of time, don't let this fester at the appeals court. Don't let this be subject to further deliberation. Take this case, review it, because ultimately you're going to be taking it anyway. Take that case and resolve it now. Just this past week, on Friday, the Court of Appeals, again, having scheduled this decision, this oral argument for January 9th, heard from the United States Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court said they will not hear the case on Trump's immunity defense for now. The Supreme Court issuing a one-sentence order, so we don't know exactly who said what, but presumably a majority, at least a majority of the United States Supreme Court, rejecting Jack Smith's request to leapfrog, if you will, over the appeals court and get a decision in the interest of time. The United States Supreme Court declining to issue a writ of certiorari as to the lower court here, declining to take that case, and basically setting up the oral argument before the appeals court for January 9th, unfettered by any prior decision that the federal Supreme Court would take. Now, what does that mean? Well, certainly it means that Jack Smith, disappointed by that result, concerned once again about picking a jury in 10 short weeks if this major case has got to be resolved about immunity. And by the way, as a footnote to this, again, as I've indicated implicitly, if not explicitly, the argument itself, as Tanya Chutkan said, a ridiculous one. The notion that somehow the president is immune from criminal prosecution, that you can do whatever you want, as Donald Trump has sometimes said when he is the president of the United States of America, cannot be the case, cannot be the rule of law in the United States of America, should not be a difficult issue for any judge, any justice to resolve. That also animating Jack Smith's interest in getting this resolved quickly. Resolve this clear issue. This is not complicated. Get us back to the trial court. Keep that on track. Well, the Supreme Court is saying we're not going to review that until the appeals court, the D.C. Court of Appeals, has had its chance to weigh in. Those three judges, again, Judge Henderson, Judge Pan, and Judge Childs, reviewing all of that. What could happen? Well, let us assume that that three-judge panel will hopefully unanimously find that the immunity doctrine does not apply. The petitioners on behalf of Donald Trump could seek what's called an en banc review, having all of the judges, not just three of them, of the circuit court review of the case. If that is the situation, that could further delay things. And ultimately, depending upon what that en banc review, all the judges might decide, that case then could also likely be reviewed ultimately by the Supreme Court, getting it back to where Jack Smith wanted it in recent days based upon his petition there. All of that, as I said before, raising once again the major issue that's going to animate us in 2024, which is timing. Tick-tock. How quickly can all this get done as we move forward in these elections and significantly the trials, this one coming up in early March, 10 weeks from this coming Monday. When we come back, we'll talk about something else that the Supreme Court decided not to do, and then we're going to move on to another major area having to do with the future of America. Stay with us for that important discussion.
Locked me out and threw a feast.
What?
The world moves on another day, another drama.
Rice Lake's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark.
If it feels like everyone has a cold at your holiday gathering, there's probably a reason. 23 states right now say they're experiencing high or very high levels of respiratory illness. ABC medical correspondent Dr. Darian Sutton says this is to be expected as more people gather indoors.
We've seen a 200% increase in influenza, raising in about 44 states, a 60% increase in RSV, children under four being the most at risk, and a 50% increase in the cases of COVID, people over the age of 65 representing the most risk in terms of hospitalization and death.
Doctors say the best thing to do is to stay home if you're sick. Former President Trump on his social media platform praising the Supreme Court's rejection of special counsel Jack Smith's request to immediately weigh in on the question of presidential immunity. And officials in Gaza say more than 90 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli airstrikes today. This is ABC News.
Badgers win again. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. Wisconsin with an 80-53 victory over Chicago State. The Badgers wearing undershirts that said hashtag Walt Strong in honor of their 24-year-old former teammate, Walt McRory, who died last weekend of bone cancer. The Badgers' Stephen Crowell.
I think it was huge for us as a program. Obviously, it's the least we could do for them and their family. But just knowing Walt, he was a great guy. And like I said, the least we could do is go out and play hard and get a win for him tonight and honor him before the game. So
Marquette won their game 81-51 over Georgetown. NFL, is there any chance the Packers will underestimate the 2-12 Panthers in Carolina? Quarterback Jordan Love.
I mean, I don't think, you know, bouncing back after two losses, I definitely don't think we're going to be underestimating anybody. So, you know, I think we're going to come out Sunday with our best foot forward. You know, I think just the stretch of games we've had, losing two tough ones, we're ready to bounce back, and we're definitely not about to take this game for granted.
That's Packers quarterback Jordan Love. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
We have some fog this morning that's going to burn off. It'll stay cloudy through the day today with a high right around 44 this afternoon. The wind out of the south at 5 to 15. Tonight, cloudy showers late tonight, our low 39. Tomorrow, cloudy with rain, a high of 50. More rain, maybe mixing with a little snow tomorrow night into Christmas Day. I'm meteorologist Sean Cable. Right now, it's 39.
Did you know there's an actual Candy Cane Lane in Wisconsin? It's only real during the holidays, but one Milwaukee area neighborhood has been sharing its holiday cheer for close to 40 years. 300 residents along West Oklahoma Avenue in West Dallas decorated to be part of Candy Cane Lane this year, free to drive through and enjoy. But since 1984, $3 million in donations have been raised and given to the MAC Fund to fight cancer. I'm Terry Barr. From all of us with the Civic Media Radio Network, happy holidays.
Hi, we're the Goo Goo Dolls. We're fortunate that our daughters have what they need to grow and learn. But that isn't the case for nearly 13 million kids in the U.S. that struggle with hunger.
Childhood hunger is a heartbreaking reality that Feeding America is working to change. Each year, the Feeding America network of food banks rescues billions of pounds of good food that would have gone to waste and provides it to families and children in need.
You can help kids in need in your community by visiting feedingamerica.org.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Timeout.
All right. Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
I was proud to be a soldier.
I told the truth and got kicked out.
And so I thought to myself, I'm taking this rule down.
If you're an LGBTQ plus veteran, your memories are important too. Share your story with the Library of Congress Veterans History Project, where firsthand accounts from U.S. military veterans are preserved and made accessible for researchers and future generations. Visit loc.gov/vets to submit your stories, photographs, and documents today.
Sawyer County's choice for news, talk, and sports. The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
We are back here on our morning discussion talking about all things courts in America, the state of Wisconsin, the state of Colorado, and the United States Supreme Court as well. Let's take some inventory of the kinds of cases right now pending or likely to be pending before the Supreme Court in connection with Donald Trump. We know from our previous discussion, the Supreme Court also has this case involving whether or not the obstruction statute, under which several hundred of the rioters on January 6th were convicted, whether that's a legitimate invocation of that particular statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 1512, significant because it also is one of the two counts in the indictment against Donald Trump, also premised upon that same statute. So having a great impact upon not only those convictions, those prosecutions, but also the prosecution of Donald Trump being led by Jack Smith out of the Department of Justice. Also, we know, presumably, highly likely, the Supreme Court is going to take up this Colorado case about whether or not the president, former president's name should appear on the primary ballot there in Colorado, having implications for the 14th Amendment application in other states around the nation as well. And then also this executive immunity issue, which we just talked about before the break, going away for a while, but almost certainly coming back to the Supreme Court. So three major cases almost certainly pending before the Supreme Court, having to do with Donald Trump and having to do with the election, having to do with the future of America as we go forward. All of that pending before the Supreme Court. Supreme Court, again, just this past week saying we're not going to review, at least for now, this decision of the lower court finding that immunity, the immunity protection, that theory does not apply to Donald Trump. They'll be revisiting that at some point down the road. Supreme Court did something else of significance off the subject matter of election, but significant given our focus on this broadcast on firearms and the capacity of legislatures, even in the wake of recent cases called Heller and Bruin, to pass legislation that keeps us safe and secure and keeps firearms consistent with the Second Amendment. The Supreme Court just this past week left in place an Illinois ban on AR-15 semi-automatic weapons. You may recall that we've talked about this before. You may recall that Illinois passed a ban on assault weapons after, in 2022, the Independence Day parade shooting, that having left 7 people dead, 48 wounded. We recall that well, right? The gunman in that July 4th shooting fired 83 rounds under a minute using an AR-15 and prompting not only the horror, the condemnation of the entire nation of what happened, that catastrophic event compromising safety and security, well-being, not only for the people there in Highland Park, but for all of us in the nation. But the legislature in Illinois passing then a ban that prevents people from owning semi-automatic weapons, and exactly the same kind of weapon that the shooter in that July of 2022 shooting used to rain havoc and rain violence upon the people of Highland Park, prohibiting the use and the owning of those semi-automatic weapons, along with magazines that enable handguns and rifles to fire off many rounds without reloading. That decision by the legislature was appealed, of course, to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, and a split panel, the Seventh Circuit, upheld that law, writing that the Supreme Court's recent decision in Bruin on the right to bear law arms extends only to weapons in common use for a lawful purpose and not to the kinds of automatic weapons that are much more like machine guns and military-grade weaponry than they are like the many different types of firearms that are used for individual self-defense. Again, drawing this distinction based upon what is and is not prohibited under the Second Amendment. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, our circuit here in Wisconsin, also Illinois and Indiana, coming to that decision. Why is it coming up again just this past couple of weeks or so? The Supreme Court has recently indicated it is not going to review that decision from the Seventh Circuit, not going to issue an order based upon the merits. But basically the reason why that is so significant is it leaves in place as the law of the land of the Seventh Circuit this legislative enactment signed by Governor Pritzker in the state of Illinois, prohibiting again the use, possession of semi-automatic weapons and other things like magazines, enabling the handguns and rifles to fire off many rounds
those kinds of things, that remains in place. That is a major affirmation that even the wake of Bruin, even the wake of Bruin, this legislation, this litigation that resulted in Bruin, that said that in order to support a legislative enactment, you got to look back to history, to the founding fathers, the times that our nation was being formulated, to find a predicate to support the restriction on firearms, even in the wake of Bruin. That standard, the Seventh Circuit finding that the prohibition on semi-automatic weapons can stand, and the United States Supreme Court not overturning that decision, leaving it in place, leaving that major firearms decision in place for all of us, a movement toward further safety and security for all of us. And also, once again, underscoring the decision-making process that the Supreme Court has when it comes to deciding what cases to decide and which ones it doesn't. As I said before, 50 cases as of this morning pending before the United States Supreme Court, two of them from our Seventh Circuit, one of them having to do with something called the Armed Career Criminal Act. Another one just added recently, also coming up from the Supreme Court, two cases coming out of the Seventh Circuit, a second one having to do with whether or not criminalizing the taking of gratuities by individuals in official capacities, a statute number 666, sort of ominous in the federal code, that now being reviewed by the United States Supreme Court from a decision of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. We turn now, as we have in recent issues as well, recent broadcasts talking about these issues, to a future under a Donald Trump presidency. We have talked before about the series of cases where the Supreme Court has granted certiorari, three in particular, one of them having to do with the future of the Securities and Exchange Commission, that case called Jarchese. Another one having to do with the future of the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That case also argued before the Supreme Court, determining whether or not those agencies are legitimate based upon different arguments, different formulations of attacks upon them. But those two cases join another case called Raimondo, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, the Supreme Court also granting certiorari in that case. And that is the big one among these three cases that are attacking the legitimacy of our administrative agencies, the decision-making processes by civil servants, non-political people rendering decisions based upon expertise, this Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo case determining whether or not the deference usually granted, traditionally granted by federal judges to expertise when a statute is not clear or is ambiguous. That decision now coming up for oral argument in mid-January, January 17th, I would argue that in addition to the other major cases having to do, yes, with Donald Trump, having to do with firearms, having to do with social media, these matters involving what's called the administrative state and the attack on our administrative state, that Raimondo case among the most important decisions being rendered, being reviewed by the Supreme Court in this present term, which gets us back to this other attack, which is premised upon a vision for America that's been articulated by Donald Trump from him directly, by his campaign in writings and in orally. In past discussions of this, we have spent some time, specifically last time, talking about Project 2025, which is this major umbrella approach that does include this attack on our administrative agencies that we're also now seeing codified, if you will, in the briefs and the arguments being made to the United States Supreme Court. But it goes much beyond that. It goes beyond that to extend to something called the unitary executive theory. This unitary executive theory that basically says that the executive branch has great powers when it comes to oversight and decision-making of administrative agencies responsible directly to the White House and not exercising, in many cases, the independent authority given to those agencies by the Congress. A lot of that, a part of this Project 2025 that we've talked about before. Last broadcast, we also talked at great length about one of the additional related approaches that the Trump campaign is presently articulating with respect to the Department of Justice, and specifically the statements by Donald Trump that if he returns to the White House, he will use his Department of Justice, as he has said, to take vengeance on his political adversaries. He'll appoint a special prosecutor, he said, to go after President Biden and his family. He would also do other things to use the Department of Justice in a way that does not affirm its independence when it comes to making legitimate decisions about who to prosecute and who not to prosecute. We spent a lot of time in the last broadcast talking about that very significant rule of law change that would once again return Donald Trump to the White House in a way that would affect the very operation, the day-to-day operation of our rule of law. Today, I want to spend our remaining time together talking about four other areas, in the areas of immigration and military use, and also the federal bureaucracy and the employment of individuals, including lawyers, in a future Trump presidency. Let's talk about immigration. Why is that? Why is that a rule of law issue? Often said by presidents, by sage diplomats, by other folks out there who think about the rule of law, it says that one of the tests of a legitimate republic, a good democracy, is how you treat two kinds of people. One of them are the people you imprison, the people you put in prison, how you treat them, even though they have violated your basic social mores and social mechanisms and violated your criminal law, both state and federal. How you treat them in prison is a signal of the extent to which you are a true republic who cares even about those people who are in prison. That's a basic signal of how you care about the people who are in prison. That's a basic signal about who you are as a nation. And the other category that also reflects on the democracy, the republic that you've established, is how you treat people who are seeking asylum, seeking to come here as immigrants. That's the other major category that is a test, if you will, about the strength of the republic. What has Donald Trump said about what he tends to do when it comes to that rule of law issue? He has talked recently about vermin. He has talked about poisoning the blood of America when it comes to people seeking asylum, seeking immigration processes in this state. And he is planning, as he has said, a major assault on immigration in a scale that we have not seen in modern American history. He is talking once again about barring millions of undocumented immigrants from this country and moving them back outside of our nation, bolstered by, as he has said, agents reassigned from other federal law enforcement agencies, even taking state police officers, National Guard, officials with Immigration and Customs Enforcement. That's the ICE agency inside the Department of Homeland Security, moving all sorts of law enforcement folks, carrying out sweeping raids to accomplish this attack upon immigrants and people seeking asylum in our nation by doing what? He's promised sweeping raids aimed at deporting millions of people every single year. That is what he has said on the campaign trail and from his campaign. He has talked about military funds being used to erect sprawling camps to hold undocumented detainees who are present here in this nation. He's talked about once again declaring a public law emergency that would be invoked to shut down asylum requests based upon people who are seeking asylum arriving at our border, much as he did during the course of COVID-19, reinvigorating that public health emergency law to keep people from entering this country seeking asylum. And the government would also be, he would try to end very significantly something that would be contrary to our very Constitution, ending the notion of birthright citizenship, the notion that if you are born in this country, you are a citizen of the nation, basically saying that if you're born of people who are immigrants who are here seeking asylum, if you're born in this nation, you do not have the right guaranteed you under the Constitution. All of that, a part of this immigration crackdown. When we come back in our final segment, talking about other ways in which a Trump presidency would be changing the rule of law in America, stay with us for that important discussion.
I have this dream, my daughter-in-law kills me for the money. She thinks I left them in the will. The family gathers around and reads it, and then someone screams out, she's laughing up at us from that.
You're listening to The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
Hi, I'm Pete Schwabe, an actor, writer, director, and comedian.
Join me for my new show, Nightlight, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We'll chill after a long day in traffic, talking politics, or trying to look busy at work. We'll talk movies, TV, theater, music, and lots of fun Wisconsin stuff. So mix an old-fashioned and join the discussion. We'll go from Wisconsin to Hollywood and back, and you can still be in bed by 10. It's Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights from 8 to 10. On the Buzz of the North, 910 AM, WBZH.
When President Joe Biden visited the Wisconsin Black Chamber of Commerce in Milwaukee, your local Civic Media radio stations had it covered live. News Director Terry Bell.
Heard a lot about Bidenomics and his plan to grow the economy by growing the middle class out as opposed to the upper class down.
And Earl Ingram.
Credit the Biden administration. He's already made things happen.
Your place for special live coverage. It's your local Civic Media radio station and the Civic Media app.
The Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH.
I would be complex. I would be cool. They'd say I played the field before I found someone to commit to. And that would be okay for me to do. Every conquest I had made would make me more of a boss to you.
And we are back to this, our final segment of this morning's broadcast, talking once again about the promises being made by presidential candidate Donald Trump for his second term in office. We've talked before about this attack on the administrative state. We've talked about the ways in which he would change the focus of the Department of Justice to do his bidding. We talked just before the break about his significant changes in immigration policy and immigration crackdown, changing the ways in which we have traditionally done not only applications for asylum, but also handling the important issue of immigration in our nation, promising that as well. Other things also articulated by the former president, by his campaign, promises made about what will happen if he becomes the next president of the United States of America, plans to use military force closer to home and indeed at home. We know that during the course of his term in office, Donald Trump sort of mused about using the military to attack drug cartels in Mexico. And that idea has taken on some even broader implications as he thinks about another term in office. We know that it is generally illegal to use federal troops for domestic law enforcement purposes. We do not use our armed forces to enforce domestic laws. That's what our police forces are all about in our country. But a law called the Insurrection Act creates one exception, a notable carve-out to that prohibition generally on using federal troops to enforce domestic law. And after some anti-police violence demonstrations in 2020 became riots, Donald Trump actually had an order drafted to use troops, to use those federal troops to crack down on protesters in Washington, D.C. significantly. Historically, we know that he never signed that particular order. But the prospect of using federal troops again inside our country, again, not to engage in war overseas, but inside our country domestically, continues to entice him plainly. He said that his top immigration folks would use the Insurrection Act at the southern border, once again, to promote the immigration issues we talked about just a few moments ago, and suggested a rally in Iowa just this past year that he intends to unilaterally send troops into Democratic-run cities to enforce public order, invoking the Insurrection Act to do that, for again, to bring military force into our domestic environments, traditionally always handled by local law enforcement. A major change, not without some judicial authority out there. The Insurrection Act, judicially enforced, legislatively put in place in those rare instances, and it has been invoked, but rare instances where there's an absolutely compelling need to invoke it. Donald Trump talking about invoking the Insurrection Act, making reference to invoking it on his first day in office to provide this kind of intrusion into the domestic operation of law enforcement in our nation. Also a part of this agenda, talking about changing in ways in which he has control over the federal bureaucracy and the workforce in particular, obviously focusing upon these civil servants inside our many agencies are out there, but a part of this concept called the unitary executive theory. We've talked about that a lot.
which says basically the president can directly command an entire federal bureaucracy, and that it is unconstitutional under this theory for the Congress to create pockets of independent decision-making authority. Well, so part of that plan, again, going back to history, we know that Donald Trump also intends, based upon what he's done before, to revive an effort from the end of his prior presidency to alter civil service rules that protect career government professionals. Basically, it would enable him to fire tens of thousands of federal workers and replace them, what he's described as loyalists. After Congress failed to enact legislation to block such a change, the Biden administration fairly recently developing a regulation to essentially prevent that kind of a change. But Donald Trump says that he is going to implement that. It's a thing called Schedule F, which again was put together at the end of his presidency. He did not sign it. It wasn't a part of his executive order at the time, but basically would enable the president under this new Schedule F to render these civil service servants providing important support to all of us in the agencies, enabling him to fire them if indeed he does not like their politics, not like their decision-making, providing him with a mechanism for attacking the federal bureaucracy and the workforce in a way that he has not previously done. All of that, a part of this plan under Project 2025. Again, none of this based upon statements made by opposition, but statements coming from Donald Trump himself and Donald Trump's campaign about his vision for the Department of Justice, for administrative agencies, for the workforce, for the federal bureaucracy, for immigration and asylum, and also the kinds of people that he will bring into his circle of operation to implement all of this, focusing, as we know well, based upon reporting, identifying, yes, indeed, lawyers who will help him implement all of this. All of that a part of the commission being given by this present candidate to a future Trump presidency, if indeed he is elected president of the United States of America in November of 2024. As we conclude this series of discussions about a future presidency, I want to do a programming note here about what we're going to do next Saturday, the final broadcast of our broadcast every Saturday morning. We're going to talk, number one, about things we can all do in 2024 as we enter into this period of heavy civics focus, lots of trials, plainly lots of campaigning, lots of elections as well. We're also going to provide you some specific answers to some of the questions that some of you asked about what would happen, indeed, in 2024 if Donald Trump is convicted, for example, in any of these federal or state cases now pending against him. What about the 14th Amendment? We're going to chat about that in a little bit greater detail. We'll answer the question whether or not Donald Trump, if he were to be convicted, could vote. Could he himself vote in the very election in November of 2024? And this interesting question as well, some of you have written in, focused on this as well. What happens if Donald Trump is elected from prison? Is it possible that he could be in jail? Could you be elected from prison? All these kinds of things we're going to be talking about next week, along with a question about what might happen if he is elected with a case still in progress. All of that going to be a part of our discussion. More importantly, next week, as a part of our overall discussion, we'll look into 2024, some ideas, some suggestions about the new year as we go from 2023 into the new year, thinking about civics, thinking about law and government and the administration of justice in our nation. Join us again next week. Join me and Anya for our discussion of those things and other matters right here on our Saturday morning broadcast. Happy holidays, everyone. Then I'd be the mayor.
From Birchwood to Poplar, this is the Buzz of the North, 910 AM WBZH, your home for news, talk, and sports. The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. It's your hometown radio, refreshed.
We here at WBZH The Buzz have partnered with the Hayward Chamber of Commerce to remind you to shop local this holiday season. Small local businesses are the lifeblood of the community, and preserving them is key to preserving those things we most enjoy about the Northwoods. Small businesses are the first in local employment and charitable giving, and shopping local is the best way to stimulate a small-town economy. The Hayward Chamber of Commerce and WBZH The Buzz are especially thankful to those who choose local small businesses first this holiday season.
This is the Buzz of the North. WBZH 910 AM, W245 CT Hayward, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Brian Clark.